James the Just, James the Righteous. The man who wrote this letter was Jesus' younger brother, and he wrote it at the time of the first synod of the Christian Reformed Church, Acts 15. What was going on is that the church was ethnic. Ethnic. All the names were Jewish. And the question was whether someone without a Jewish name, without a Jewish background, without a Jewish patrimony, without a Jewish matrimony, would be able to become a member of this wonderful, delightful, but exclusive society. And everybody said, yes, they can. They can. But first they have to get a Jewish name. First they have to be like us. They can't be part of our fellowship unless they are like us. And that's what the first synod of the Christian Reformed Church was all about in Acts 15. The man who presided as chair was Jesus' little brother, James. He was a man everybody respected. Even those who didn't like his theology respected him, so much so that Josephus tells us he was called James the Righteous, James the Just, even by those who opposed him, even by those who would in 62 AD push him from the corner of the temple, trying to kill him, failing, and then picking up stones and stoning him to death. This is the James that writes this letter. He probably wrote it at the time of that first synod. There's a short letter we find in Acts 15. James says we've got to explain these things to everybody, so they write a short little report, synodical report, and send it out with a few things that people ought to be doing. You can see it in Acts 15. And James says, I want to send a longer letter to the churches, reminding them that we are one in the Spirit, one in the bond of love. And his letter echoes and resonates with that. When I read the letter of James, I'm reminded of that story of the family that lived on the edge of the dark woods. No, not Laura Ingalls Wilder. This was a family that mother and father and a young girl, and they told her regularly that she ought to watch where she plays and what she does, and she should not wander into the forest, for she could get lost. It was a big forest. It was a deep forest. It was a dark forest. Don't go in there, or you will probably get lost. But one day, as she was chasing a butterfly, and you know how butterflies can go this way and that, without her knowing it, she went into the forest behind their home. And as she followed the butterfly and was amazed by the birds and all of the insects and the beautiful things and the light coming streaming among the branches of the trees, she went on and on till she was way lost. And there wasn't the possibility of her finding her way back. There, the afternoon shadows got deeper, the gray got darker, and the gloaming turned into night. She was alone, and she had cried, and she had run, and she had rushed, and she had called, but to no avail. She was lost. She was lost. Meanwhile, at home, mother was worried. Father was worried. They called to her. They could not find her. She was missing. They started looking into the edges of the forest, calling her name, but they could not find her. They called their neighbors together and their friends and the whole village, come, help us find our daughter. They went beating into the forest, trying to find behind every bush, under every large overhang to see whether she was there, but they could not find her. They could not find her, and finally, one by one, the neighbors went home. The villagers went home, and only with his horse voice constantly calling her name, the father was there all through the night. The little girl had tired herself with her calls, her uncertainty where she was, her jumbled mind and thoughts, until she whimpered herself to sleep in a small clearing on a bed of pine needles. And about dawn, when the father stumbled into the clearing, saw his daughter and called her name with joy, she was awakened. She got up, she ran to him, and she said to him, "Daddy, I found you." And that's what James tries to communicate in his letter. Remember the Father of lights at the beginning of the letter, whose grace comes down and who will never leave us or forsake us or do us a bad turn. This is the God that James knows. The God who is there, who will not forget us, who will not allow us to wander too far into the forest, will always seek us, but the one also who delights us when we are found in believing that we have sought the Lord and afterward we knew he moved our souls to seek him, seeking us. We're at that point, though, where James continually wags a bit of a finger at us and reminds us not to go too far into those forests from which there doesn't seem to be much of a return and where we can lose ourselves deeply. The rest of this passage that we're looking at this morning, starting at verse 13 in chapter 3, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, of the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness." Then over to chapter 4, picking up where we ended before at verse 11. "Brothers and sisters, do not slander one another. Anyone who speaks against his brother or sister or judges them speaks against the law and judges it. When you judge the law, you are not keeping it, but sitting in judgment on it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy you. The one who is able to save and destroy, but you, who are you to judge your neighbor?" Fred Craddock, great teacher of preaching from Emory or Candler School of Theology at Emory University in Atlanta, was asked to speak at a conference in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, some years ago. He flew up there. Unfortunately, the conference was being held in January. Now, across the open plains of the Midwest, there can come times when it's just cold. And then there can come times when it's much worse than cold. And this was one of those times that by the time the plane landed in Winnipeg, it was a sheer whiteout. The winter storms had come in, and even Pastor Craddock was not able to get from the airport to the church where the conference was being held. He called the pastor. The pastor said, "We are snowed in. We can't get a vehicle out there. See if someone will take you to the hotel." Well, he managed to find one taxi driver that was willing to brave things for the sake of a fare, and a very long ride on what should have been a short trip, they managed to get to the hotel. Once Fred got there, he knew that he was not going to be speaking at a conference, and he called the pastor, and the pastor says, "We've had to cancel everything. This is not going to work out. You're going to have to fend for yourselves and yourself and get back to Atlanta in whatever way you can." Well, there was no flight to be had that day, so Fred was stuck there overnight. He asked the person at the front desk if there was a place where he could get a meal. The hotel was so small that it didn't have any restaurant on site. The closest, said the guy at the desk, is the bus station. It's about a little less than half a mile down the street. It's too far to walk, but, well, what is he going to do? So there was a little coffee shop at the bus station, and Fred started going through the snow, realizing that his Atlanta shoes were no match for this Winnipeg weather. But he stumbled to the place and saw the dirty bus depot and the coffee shop, which was even more dirty, and the windows, which were all fogged over with the human element breathing inside on a very cold day. He managed to step inside, and it was wall-to-wall people. There were people everywhere. They were just trying to get out of the cold. Everyone knew this was a desperate situation, and even though there were no chairs available at any of the tables or seats on the benches, at one of the booths, the people looked at him, and they kind of nodded, and everybody was communicating in a language which was neither American nor Canadian, but they knew what it was, and he came over to their table, and they slid in a little bit further, and he slid in with them. And when the wait person came, he asked for just a bowl of soup. The bowl of soup came quickly, but it was rather gray and tasteless, and it just seemed like it would maybe nourish him long enough to get out of there. Shortly after he began sipping his soup, a woman came in through the door. There was a bell above it, so everybody knew when somebody else was coming in. She came in, and there was no room, but of course, people also made room for her, and she sat down, and the proprietor of the place was now doing the wait staffing, and he came over to her and said, "What do you want?" She said, "I'll have a glass of water." He said, he brought her the water, and he said to her, "Okay, what do you want to order?" She said, "Really, I don't need anything, and I don't have money for it, but I just need to get warmed up." He said, "Look, we're busy here. There are too many people who want to come in, and we don't have place for those who are not going to purchase anything, so you're going to have to leave." "Can I just sit here for a few minutes?" she said, "and get thawed out?" "No, if you're not going to order anything, you have to get out of her." Well, she fumbled with her coat and her purse and a few other things and began to stand. And the people at her table, whom she did not know, began to shuffle and stand. And the people next to them began to shuffle and stand until, like a pandemic, it spread through the room. And everybody was shuffling and standing and moving toward the door with this woman who was not wanted. All right, yelled the proprietor. "She can sit here for a while." And suddenly everybody breathed a sigh of relief and sat down. And Fred said to the person next to him, "Do you know her?" "No," he said, "never saw her before. But if she can't be here to get a little warmth, I can't be here either." Fred took another sip of his soup. He said it suddenly tasted different. It began to remind him of something. And then it came to him. The bread and the wine of the Lord's Supper. For something holy had just happened. And people who didn't know one another, weren't obligated to care for one another, had become body, had become those who saw each other and took care of one another and said, "We're in this together." There are a variety of ways in which we interact with one another. Someone who has written a book on leadership says there are really five kinds of ways in which leadership happens among us. One of those is by position. This past week, I was in Istanbul. I was staying very close to Hagia Sophia, the great church built in the 6th century, become a mosque, become a museum, become a mosque. place of incredible community and holiness in the middle of strife and tension. And all around us, order reigned. Because all around us, there were people with dark uniforms carrying multiple guns, pointing them in directions where they heard of tension and loud cries. We respond to those in authority, in positional authority over us. We respond to those who have a position which demands respect, a position which demands attention. There's a second kind of relationship that develops in our societies, and that is one of performance. Whoa! Can you imagine what it's like to be one of the greats, the goats, the greatest of all time, the ones who can throw passes that always connect, the ones who can make 30, 40 points on the basketball court, the ones who can produce great writings, the ones who can lift high the songs that cause albums to be purchased and networks to come down and concert halls to be filled. The persons of performance who can do great things among us, and we worship them even if we don't want to. There is also among us the possibility of persuasion. Relationships not only of position or of performance, but of persuasion, whereby the incredible capacity to influence. We even have a term for it in our society. Social influencers who use the media, TikTok and other things, in order to become persons of influence who can change the way that communities think, cause the tipping point to go in this direction or that direction, cause things to be bought and other things to be panned. Influencers, persuasion, demagogues who speak and people will come to their rallies, persons who will orate and people will be astounded at the beauty of their litany, of their poems, of the words that they say, persuaders. A fourth possibility in our relationships with one another is that of permission. And here in our closed space, we all have closed space. Notice the closed space as you move off into the North Hall for a coffee later on. We have a particular protocol for space that I own. I know that I did not build this building and that I did not participate in paying the mortgage, whether it's paid off or not, but I tell you right now, I own this space. And don't you come too close to me, because I own this space. When we lived in Nigeria, we found that the space we owned had shrunk. And my students and those in the marketplace cared nothing for the space that I claimed. They came in. They invaded. My space was no longer sacred. I determined that I have a certain amount of space. And then what happens? We sometimes, I don't know if it's happened to you or to anybody that you're acquainted with, we fall in love and we invite people into our space and we can't get close enough to them. By permission, the two become one. Four kinds of relationships we have with one another. And then there's the fifth, according to this particular writer. And that's the authority, the relationship of personhood. Personhood. Where someone does not need to command us based upon guns or uniforms or positional authority, where someone does not need to persuade us of something, where someone does not need to perform in order to get our attention, where someone does not even to provide us with the permission to enter into their space, but by their very character, they change the atmosphere. They make things different. I like me better when I'm with so-and-so. Did you ever have that? Whatever you are, good as you are, wonderful as you are, competent as you are, hateful as you are, nasty as you are, when you're with certain persons, there is an aura which exudes from them, and we become better than we thought we were. I like me better when I'm with her. I like me better when I'm with him. Robert Fulghum said this about Mother Teresa. He didn't have a faith, he thought. He had given that up long ago. But he was in Oslo. He was going to cover the Nobel Prizes, and suddenly she came by, and he was standing in the crowd at the edge of the walkway, and she stopped, and she looked him in the eye. She smiled at him. She never said a word to him. He was enthralled, and she went to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And from that day forward, he says he has always kept a picture of Mother Teresa on the mirror where he looks at himself first when he gets up in the morning, in order that he can remind himself what he can be in the light of her presence. And isn't that what James is talking about here, where James talks about the gifts that come from above, the wisdom that reflects the mind of the Maker, the idea that there is a way to live in which we are knit together as people who care for one another, that matter to one another, that have personhood, because there is person who became flesh and walked among us. Yeah, it was my older brother, Jesus, says James. But I'm his servant, he says up front. Somehow in the presence of the person of Jesus, Jew and Gentile, our kind and their kind, my political party and everybody else, our team versus their team, these things no longer matter. And we become persons of influence, not by permission or position or performance or persuasion, but because the Spirit of God lives within us. Margaret Mead was the great cultural anthropologist of an earlier generation. She spent much of her younger years in the Samoan Islands, observing how people grew and interacted, how parents looked after children, how children became adults, the culture, the mating rituals, the birthing rituals, the death rituals, all of that. She became an expert on Samoan culture. Coming of Age in Samoa was her great work that so many read. She was speaking at a conference one time at a university, And at the end of her speech, there was time for Q&A, for question and answer, and microphones positioned in such a way that all could come to the microphones. And one of the students came and said to her, some thought maybe perhaps trying to trip her up or to get her to say something foolish. Ms. Mead, what do you consider to be the first sign of civilization in any community? She thought for a moment, and of course there were many answers that she might give. She could talk about the domestication of animals. She could talk about the husbandry of goods and of food so that we are no longer gatherers from distances, but we can grow our own food. The development of laws or the possibility of language which goes beyond symbol. All of those kinds of things. But here's what she said. Here's what Ms. Mead said. I consider the first sign of civilization in any people is the evidence of a healed femur. This is your femur. This is your bone. We call it a femur. Why? She explained. The law of the jungle is this: you fall, you die. Right? If you are being chased by the beasts, and you trip and you break your femur, you fall and you cannot move and you are gobbled up. If you are running before the enemy and you fall and break your femur, you cannot get away and you will die. If you're by yourself and you're climbing over stones and you're going up mountains and you fall and you break your femur, you die. Because you cannot get yourself to a place of safety, you cannot take care of yourself, you cannot get yourself food, you cannot get water. If, however, said Ms. Mead, there is the indication in our archaeological excavations of a healed femur, this is what it means, that someone fell and should have died. But there was someone else who stood guard, who fended off the enemies, who raised a burning, blazing torch to the animals, who guarded the person with her life, who took the person from the place of danger, dragged the person to a place of safety, who at expense to her own self or his own self went out and foraged and got food, who came and protected the person, nursed the person until the person's bone had healed, who brought food enough for two, who brought water enough for two, who protected a life that was at risk in the law of the jungle where you fall and you die. But this person fell. And this person did not die. And isn't that the metaphor of what Jesus has done? The one who has come into a world where we kill children in schools with guns. The one who has come into a world where nations can simply take over other territory because it seems like that's what we want to do. A world in which even good people have nasty thoughts and nice families break up with marriage and spouses beat on one another and people shave their income tax and don't pay their way in life and where gossip kills before bullets do. And then comes Jesus, and then comes Jesus. And by the power of his personhood, he makes us ashamed, and then he makes us loved, and we have to put his picture on the mirror that we look into every morning when we get up, because there's something about him that changes who we are. This is what James says again to us today. Do you believe it? Will you live it? Pray with me. Thank you, Jesus, for